Dr. Morrison, could you tell me what year you were born?
I was born in 1917.
Where was that?
It was Barbas, Saskatchewan. B-A-R-V-A-S.
Is that closer to some larger town?
Yes, that's about 17, 18 miles straight east of Yorkton, Saskatchewan.
What was your father's occupation in that area?
My father homesteaded, or my grandfather homesteaded in that area in 1889. My father, after the Boer War, he served in the Boer War, took a homestead adjacent to his father's at that point in time. That would be about 1899, 1902, somewhere in there.
Where was your grandfather from?
Originally, he's from Lewis, or beg your pardon, my paternal grandfather is from Harris. My maternal grandfather is from Lewis, Scotland.
Where did you attend school?
I took my first 10 grades in the Glasgow School District, which is a small one-room country school, a mile away from where I was originally born.
After school, after you finished graduating from high school, what did you do?
Well, I thought I did my first 10 grades. The 9th and 10th I did by correspondence, and then from there I went to Regina to take my 11 and 12 Scott Collegiate Institute in Regina. And I took another year at Luther College for the first year art. And I started my apprenticeship as a pharmacy in Regina, Saskatchewan, and then latterly in Belterra.
Where were you an apprentice, which town?
Well, I started my apprenticeship in Regina, Saskatchewan with what was then the Champlain Drugs, and I served approximately a year with Champlain Drugs, and then I went with Mr. Salter, who had a pharmacy in Regina and had a pharmacy in Abernethy, Saskatchewan, and one in Belterra, Saskatchewan, and I sort of alternated between the three for the next 3 years. I served 4 years apprenticeship before I went to the University of Saskatchewan. That was not because I had to, that was because of choice of finances at that point in time.
I see. Was this the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon?
That's correct.
Was this to get your degree in pharmacy?
Well, at that point in time, they had what was known as a diploma or certificate. This was a two-year course following 2 years of apprenticeship. That was the minimum. You had 2 years of apprenticeship, then you could start your two-year certificate course, and then you had a year of apprenticeship after graduation. In my case, I took 4 years of apprenticeship before I went up, as I said a moment ago, because of financial limitations. So I started my certificate or diploma course in 1904.
See. There was a COTC unit at the
time. Yes, at that time, all males attending university had to take some military training, which is the year after the war started. And I was enrolled in the COTC, University of Saskatchewan, as an officer cadet.
Do you think you would have enrolled in the COTC if it wasn't compulsory?
Yes, I think I would have. Looking back on it, I don't think there's any doubt of it that I would have been in the COTC or some such similar organization.
Why do you say that?
Well, I say this, I suppose maybe one has to look at the period that, with the war being on, I had, prior to going to Saskatchewan, going to the university, had really made up my mind that either if I went to university, I would join COTC and get some military training that way, or else I wasn't going to university one of the services directly, and then do my university after. And I finally decided on the latter, that I'd go on at least for 1 year and then and start my university program. Having decided on this, then of course COTC was an obvious choice after I got there,
yeah.
from a military point of view.
Do you remember something of the unit at the University of Saskatchewan, facilities, for example?
Well, I can remember in this respect that we were using equipment of the First World War vintage, in essence, to train with. The personnel, the instructors, many of them were ex servicemen from the First World War. Others, of course, who instructors were people who were in the reserve force between the period of the First and Second World War. The lectures and the most equipment, I say, we had at that point in time were ancient vintage, if you want to look at it.
Did you have an armory or a drill hall?
No, not as such. We used the outdoors, of course, when it was mild enough to do this, but we used the, I suppose what we'd call the odd large field house at that time, and for drill purposes and for training purposes.
How long were you in the CATC?
I spent 2 years, 1940 to 42, while I was attending the University of Saskatchewan. 1942, I received my diploma in pharmacy, which at that point in time would have licensed me to practice pharmacy in Saskatchewan. In May of 42, I then had the opportunity to go to officers' training school. So I joined the active force, the Army, more specifically the infantry, and came out to Gordon Head, British Columbia here, and completed my officers' training for the second lieutenant. Right.
How did the training at COTC differ from Gordon Head?
Well, of course, COTC was one night a week, and rather basic elementary training. Well, Gordon Head, of course, was a concentrated 3-month program. We started in May and we finished in August, and it was a full every day. It was a regular military training program. And we had, of course, instructors there. That some of them had returned from overseas. This was, by this time, was 42. So yeah. We had instructors who had some battle experience by this time, along with, of course, the other dedicated instructors that we had. Many of them were First World War veterans who had come back into the service.
Do any stand out in your mind, particular? Can you name one?
The CO, the chief instructor, Major Faulkner, is one that always stands out in my mind as a young man, and he was a very striking individual, and I suppose for that reason he impressed me at that point in time. There are several, no, not from Gordon Head. I guess he stood out more than anybody else. And we had a Mr. McLeod, who was our platoon commander, I always remember. He was an elderly, at that point in time, I thought he was an elderly gentleman, but he was a very conscientious, he hardly struck me as being the type of infantry officer. I always remember Mr. McLeod, a great deal of respect for him.
Was he from UTC, COTC?
No. He, my memory slips me now. He was a member of the Rocky Mountain Rangers, I believe, which was a reserve unit in BC at that point in time.
What did you do after Gordon Head?
Well, following Gordon Head, I had my second lieutenancy, and of course you had to go to qualify for our lieutenant. And we went from there then to Camp Shiloh in Manitoba, where after, I think it was approximately 6 weeks of training, we were then qualified as a lieutenant in the Canadian Army. And then there, then we specialized in our specialty arms. Shiloh was an infantry or artillery training school, and I was in the infantry, so I was in the infantry division of the school.
Specializing in small arms?
In small arms, basically, yeah.
After Camp Shiloh?
Camp Shiloh, from there, went to a basic training unit in Fort Hays La Prairie. That would be, I guess, about November of 42. And I had my first exposure as a platoon commander in the basic training center in Fort Hays La Prairie until about March of 43, at which time, then that was a usual period, I think. You had about 5 or 6 months to sort of get you used to working with men and working with people, and then we were returned to Shiloh with a view to posting overseas. We had a further 4 weeks of training before we went overseas, battle drill and the usual training that went on about that time.
Where did you first land overseas?
Well, we went over on the Empress of Scotland, I think it was, boat. We went on escorted We landed in Liverpool in June, early June of 43, and went from there to the holding unit, which was just outside of Guildford. Godalming, really, I guess is the name of the town, if my memory serves me correctly. And this was a holding unit for all reinforcement officers, infantry reinforcement officers. And then we were dispatched from there to the various units.
Did you already have a unit picked out before?
I had a unit that I wanted to go to. Of course, you had no assurance that you were going to get the unit you wanted.
Which one did you want?
Of course, I wanted the South Saskatchewan Regiment. Basically, I suppose, because I came from Saskatchewan, and I think probably the real reason for it was that I'd met a couple of, well, I guess three of the South Saskatchewan, ex-South Saskatchewan regiment, who headed me in Dieppe, and they came back for their commissions while I was at Gordon Head, and we'd become very close friends, and I was anxious to go back to the unit, to their unit, because they were going back to their unit. And fortunately, this did transpire, but I guess it was about August of 43 when I was posted to the South Saskatchewan regiment.
To digress a bit, do you remember what they said about Dieppe?
Not really, at this point in time.
After you were with the holding units in England, then what happened?
Well, I was posted, as I said, to the South Saskatchewan Regiment, which at that time was stationed in in Worthing, in the city of Worthing, and I spent the winter with them as a platoon commander. Commanded number 16 platoon and dog company. I was with them then, and we moved out in May into Kent, into Canvas, obviously in preparation for what everybody expected would be D-Day. And I left them in, I guess it was May of 44, just prior to D-Day.
Where did you go?
Well, I was posted to Army headquarters as ADC to the Canadian Army Commander, General H.D.G. Currer.
How did you get this position?
Well, that's probably a difficult one to answer because I'm not quite sure. My CO did tell me after that he had been requested, I suppose, come down from the upper echelons to nominate one or two people from his regiment who had had some university training. And I happened to fit the bill as one of them, and the other person in the regiment, he just said he couldn't spare. He just had come back from intelligence officer training. So, but there were a couple of us that he had in mind. So my name went forward. That's what he, talking to Colonel, this was Colonel Freddie Clift, talking to him after the war, and he was then Brigadier Clift. This is the way he explained it to me. And I asked him the same question, why me? And this was his comments. So that I went from then, I guess early May, I went to Army headquarters, which was at Leatherhead, I guess, just outside of Aldershot, outside of London. And I then spent the rest of the war with General Currer as his aide.
As his aide. What were your duties with him?
Well, originally, my first main duty was I took the tactical headquarters over on D plus 10, I guess it was, which was a small headquarters that the general had, which included an operational setup and his armored protection. He also had a personal assistant who was my immediate superior, Colonel Weir. But I took the tactical headquarters over and got them set up in Amblay, just out of Amblay, France, and then the general came over, I forgot, a day or two later to the headquarters. That was really my first. And then for the next, the better part of 2 months, I guess, the general had no troops to command, since the Canadian Army as such wasn't constituted till later on, and D plus 30 or 40, I can't remember the exact time. So I acted sort of as an aide when he was out visiting various units or visiting the front lines. So for the next 2 or 3 months, basically I was what you might call his aide.
You must have had some concern though with the Canadian forces that were on the beachhead. Some involvement, didn't you?
Well, not directly. That's where the general used to visit them. This was the 3rd Canadian Infantry Division and their supporting troops. It's true. He was anxious to visit them, but they were not under his command at that point in time. They were under the British command. And we did, these are the troops that we did go to visit, in spite of the fact that he didn't command them, and we visit them regularly, different units, weather permitting, and of course, the operations permitting. We used to do this fairly regularly.
How would you describe the beach?
Well, as I recall it, it was pretty narrow. I think even on D plus 10, when we, some of it wasn't much more than 5 or 6 miles deep. It was not uncommon to hear the battle going on, the firing going on, particularly at night. And it was very crowded, I suppose, is one word you could use. You'd have a petrol dump in one spot and a ammunition dump across the road, and the stockpiling was in this area was really a very crowded business because of the limited beachhead we had at that point in time, and then the weather turned against us. And this is really what stymied the thing for about 2 weeks. The weather became.
How did it stymie?
Well, the delivery, the Mulberry, as it was called, this was they built the prefabricated harbor. The weather was such that it became very difficult to unload the kind of material. The seas were too rough, and it cut down the rapid buildup of the materiel that was anticipated.
Was there an atmosphere of apprehension?
Well, at my level, you probably didn't get thing, but certainly there was much concern. Yes, because of this, the inability of getting more troops in as quickly as they had anticipated, and the equipment, supporting equipment, to expand the beachhead, particularly when they run into very stiff opposition just north of Caen. They had the SS troops, and it took a fair build-up before they pushed through there. And of course, the interval while we were building up, there obviously was apprehension if they'd had a major attack, I think, from the Germans. We were pretty thin as far as depth were concerned. But I wasn't a strategist enough to probably realize that at that point in time.
Could you see the situation which was shaping up around what they call today the Battle of Falaise?
Oh yes, if you were working on the maps, which I was doing laterally, you could see what was being carried out. I mean, the design of the operation, the strategy involved. Once the buildup was large enough so that they could get the forces in. And you could see pretty much what was the encircling movement that was taking place. And as the days went by, it became pretty obvious once the breakthrough came, just a matter of time.
Yeah.
That would be in late August, September of 44. You know.
After the breaking out, you were with Canadian forces advancing through France,
were you? Well, I was essentially with tactical headquarters, the general's tactical headquarters. And we followed them up. The army headquarters per se was a pretty huge operation. So the general always went ahead with a small tactical headquarters, and he set up communications. So that we followed them. Yes, we followed them all the way up the coastline, right through until D-Day. As a small tactical headquarters, and we sort of leapfrogged as they moved up all along the coast. We went on up through Nijmegen. Well, prior to that, we followed the sea coast with the forces just behind them.
Where were you in the surrender took place?
Well, we were at headquarters just outside of Apeldoorn, I guess the little town was, Apeldoorn, Nijmegen area in Holland, on May the 8th, 1945, when the ceasefire took place. See, that was just in the same general areas where the airborne division was dropped and then got encircled in September of the previous year.
From your headquarters, were you following that particular incident?
We watched them go over, yes. We watched the planes go over. Of course, I have, in my particular position, you see, knew pretty well what was going on, because the general would get his information, his instructions from Field Marshal Montgomery, or was now Field Marshal Montgomery, and then he would come back with them, and one of my first jobs was to take these and map them in a broad sense. So you could see on the map what the overall army, or the two armies at that time, we had the British Army and the Canadian Army, and he had an American Army at that part of Montgomery did. So that I was in the, as I look back now, the preferred position. I didn't probably appreciate it at the time, of having this kind of knowledge firsthand, and could anticipate at least what were the operation battle plans. They didn't always work out the way they planned, but it was an interesting position to be in, and a position of great trust as I look back on it now, in a sense that from the point of view of secrecy.
What critical decisions would you say that you witnessed?
Well, I wasn't present at them, but I think the kind of decisions of when Montgomery wanted to take off and move head full steam ahead in the late fall of 45, and there was a great debate went on at very high levels at that point in time, with Montgomery and Eisenhower, they were comparable levels in this area. That debate still going on, of course, I think, in various areas as to whether we should or shouldn't have held back. Monty wanted to push right through. The other one, I guess, the time of the Battle of the Bulge around New Year's of 45. They had to do some quick shifting of troops in a hurry when the Germans made their push down around the Black Forest area. This was a rather exciting time as I look back on it, the decisions that were having to be made, but again, at top level, but it would filter down through to those of us in lesser positions.
Do you remember a fear of being cut off?
Not really. I don't ever feel ever have any ever thinking of this possibility happening. Perhaps we didn't have enough of the picture, the full picture, to really appreciate it. Excuse me.
How do you think the Canadian Army conducted itself in the actual war experience that you witnessed?
I would say very exemplary, both in their fighting and in their general behavior. From where I sat, at this sitting a fair distance behind where the actual fighting took place, I was up several times in the general forward areas, but certainly on the whole, I think they acquitted themselves very well in the overall fighting.
What did you do after the war?
Well, I came back and stayed with General Kruger until he retired. We came back on August the 7th, 45, and the Prime Minister of Canada then, William Lyon Mackenzie King, decided that the General should probably do a tour of Canada as the General of the Canadian Army just returned, and so I was fortunate to make that trip with him. We went from Charlottetown, PEI, to Victoria, BC, and back again, visiting essentially military units, basically army, military hospitals.
And what was the purpose of these visits?
Basically, I think it was a public relations, if you like, and exposure to the people of the Canadian Army commander who had just returned from the battlefield. He did a fair amount of speaking as he went across to clubs. I think it was primarily designed to, particularly to go to the Army units, so that you have a chance to talk to the people there.
I read in one of the reports in the UBC library that, that he did visit the COTC UBC.
That's correct. He visited the UBC, I guess it would be either late January of 46 or early February of 46.
Do you remember that meeting?
I remember the meeting, yes. I remember we were in the auditorium. I think I have a picture of one of the pictures taken that morning at home. I don't remember, I wasn't in on the discussions that took place, but I was present at the meeting at that time.
This particular report said that they did discuss the future policies regarding officer training.
Yes, I have no doubts, because General Currer was had a great deal of interest in this particular area. Matter of fact, some of the things that he was propounding about back then are seem to be transpiring today, although he was looking at it from taking the young people, and one of his philosophies was at that point in time, and he could see the officers training doing some of this, but certainly not to the scale that he was envisaging. But I think I'd be fair in saying that he envisaged a sort of a compulsory type of training, maybe not necessarily military, that would take young people from British Columbia and take them off to Ontario and bring the Ontarians out to Saskatchewan and Saskatchewan. In other words, taking the young people away from their own environment and to get them to get to know Canada, essentially, an exchange of ideas. I think a lot of this is happening today in a variety of ways. We see schools doing this, exchange programs, and General Currer, at that point in time, I can often think about it. This was one of the things that he had was very much in favor of. He could see the Canadian the officers' training corps, that type of thing, doing some of this in a very small way. Because essentially, this is what happened to our cadets when we had them. They would go back to training centers in Ontario or wherever it may be. And then there they met other young people from Canada and exchanged ideas. And this has a lot. Had at that point certainly a lot going for it.
When were you discharged?
I took my discharge in June of 46. I came after I left General Currer. I had pretty well decided I was going to stay in the Army and make the Army my career. And trying to look at the future, I had decided that perhaps airborne was the thing to do. So I applied to the parachute training center. Shiloh, I was posted there as their adjutant in May of, or in April of 46. And I stayed there until June. I guess the real reason that made me change my mind is I couldn't get very much information out of Ottawa at that point in time. It's just what was the future for people like myself who had not been regular soldiers prior to the war, and what were our likelihood of being kept in and sort of in what capacity. At the same time, I had given a lot of thought about the possibility of returning to university with the benefits that had accrued for those service people who wanted to go back. And I think there was a combination of both, the wish to go back to university and the fact that I couldn't get the kind of satisfaction from headquarters of what was the future of somebody like myself, that ultimately decided in June I went to my commanding officer then. I was acting adjutant at the para training center, and Colonel Stone was the commanding officer, and he simply suggested, well, phone Ottawa and find out, which I did, and I got a negative answer, so I asked for my discharge. I took my discharge.
Which university did you continue in?
Well, I went back, after I took my discharge in June, I went to work as a pharmacist because, as you will recall earlier, I said I had my certificate or diploma, which would give me a license, and I was a licensed pharmacist in Saskatchewan at that point in time. And this was one of the reasons I thought I'd make Army my career. I could stay until I was about 50 or 52, and then I could retire and go practice pharmacy. However, I changed my mind, but I did work in Regina for Mr. Frank Edwards for this month of June, July, August, and then I returned to the University of Saskatchewan in September of 46 and started on, or completed then my degree. Because of the fact I'd had some arts in 35, 36, I was able to complete the degree in 1 year plus a couple of summer sessions. Well, they had a pre-summer session and a summer session in Saskatchewan at that time. So I got graduated in May with the Bachelor of Science in Pharmacy in 1947. And was offered, of course, I think one of the things that made me go back to university too was the dean at the University of Saskatchewan in pharmacy at that time was Dean Woods, who was also there when I was in 40 to 42. And he had written me, well, that if I went back and got my degree, because at that time he had decided to accept the appointment out here to establish a new college of pharmacy, and he offered me a position. I went back and got my degree. So we worked out the details during the time I was getting my degree, and so I came out here in August of 47 after completing summer school at Saskatchewan, and I've been here ever since.
And when did you become involved in
COTC? I didn't get involved in the COTC here until 1951. In the fall of 51, I joined the COTC as a contingent officer.
How did you become involved?
Well, they were looking for personnel or officers, contingent officers as they were called at that time. And I approached the then commanding officer, Colonel Bonner, Colonel Robert Bonner, and I was accepted as a contingent officer. I was approached to see what I'd be interested really in. After I gave it some thought, I might as well get back into it. So I went in as a captain, which was my rank when I was discharged as a contingent officer, and stayed with the unit then until 63 or something like that. Whenever I retired, I forgot the dates now.
While a contingent officer, before you became commanding officer, what were your major, what were your duties?
Well, we at that time, of course, were parading 125 to 150 cadets, and first, second, on a three-phase basis, first, second, and a third-year training basis. And the unit, the COTC was broken down then into those three phases, and I was given sort of commanding, I think I started off with phase one and then moved up to phase two and phase three. We had junior officers with us, you see. So it would be my responsibility to look after the particular phase that I was given command of, and I did some lecturing in the military area, as well as having outside lectures, but also did some drill training, or was present at the time the drill training was being given by instructors. And this is basically what we did. We prayed it one night a week for 3 hours, and we had a regular syllabus laid down for us by the directorate in Ottawa, and we followed this syllabus.
What area did you lecture in?
Well, I lectured in man management, or as it applied to the military. You'd have some of these lectures. I lectured in the area of verbal orders, or battle orders, battle procedures, army organization. It depends what happened to be on the syllabus. We crossed over, and as you went from one phase, you have different training syllabus, you see. So you might lecture in this area this year, you might lecture in something else next year if you had a different phase of the training. And then, of course, we had a large number of outside speakers, which we always brought in.
Would you recall some?
Yes. Dr. Soward, Fred Soward, used to be a regular speaker for us. Since retired from the university, he had an annual one or two lectures with us. Dr. John Norris lectured with us for several years in the area of military history. He's now Dr. Barry Leach. lectured again in the area of military history. I guess any number of others that we used to bring in. Dr. Lewis Robinson in geography used to come in and lecture military geography. We used to use university personnel fairly heavily, who had a specialty in a particular area. And those are some of the ones that I can recall right off the top of my head.
Going back to when you first joined, do you remember having an impression of the unit? 1951?
I think my original impression of the unit, because the COGC, when we first started in 42, was a bit of a helter-skelter arrangement. The unit here, as I recall, was very well organized, and the syllabus and everything was well laid on. And this rather impressed me, the way that the whole thing had been set up, because sometimes we'd get stories, you know, and this was just sort of a play, an evening of fun and games. But the unit took their training very serious. Yeah, this impressed me right from the outset. And Colonel Bonner, and then subsequently Colonel McLean, these people were good disciplinarians, good, but well trained in the military aspect. I suppose for this reason I enjoyed the unit, because it was well organized, well managed, well run.
How would you say your own experience fitted in with your
Well, what I liked from the COTC, and what I missed very much when I got out of it, was this, at the university level, give me another out of my own immediate field, so that I had in contact with students from all walks of the university, because we drew students from all the faculties. And it's like, from a student contact, gave me this kind of contact, which I appreciated. It also gave me opportunities to meet these various speakers that probably one wouldn't have had the same opportunity in a small faculty. So it had these kind of rewards from my own personal point of view, which I enjoyed, and which I missed after the thing pulled it up.
How would you characterize the students who joined the COTC, who were selected, really?
Well, it's difficult what you mean by characterizing them.
What kind of people were there? What do you think were their ambitions or interests?
Well, basically, they were, for the most part, pretty serious young men who were looking for some training in man management, and I think this was the unfortunate connotation that COTC, or the service units on the campus, developed, that, you know, that they were training specifically for war, and I dispute this or refute this, because this wasn't basically our intent. It was part of the intent to train these young people. But I can think of a number of them who have gone out now and taken their place in the community. And on the whole, I found them a very conscientious young group. And it's interesting, like you always watch young people, see how they do mature. They've been very immature, and they spent a summer away in the military camp, and watched them over the years. But on the whole, they were young people, I think, that were interested in what they were doing, and were interested in getting some training, and many of them went back to the reserve when they finished with us, or else went on to the regular army. So in essence, we were training these people, and they went back out into the community and into the reserve area.
Let's go back again. What did you think of the armory?
Here?
Yes.
I thought we were very fortunate to have such a fine facilities for training purposes. The university was a very I know who was instrumental in setting it up, and very farsighted. We were the envy of most of the other universities across Canada, because we had our own facilities for training. We had our own facilities for lectures, for drill, for mess facilities. And as a consequence, I think this had a great deal to do with the unity within all three services, and the unity within the, each of the services. You know, there was a home base. It was a headquarters,
yeah,
which the cadets could call their own, sort of thing. And I think this was very significant.
Did you take part in the summer camps?
No, not really. As CO, when I took over as commanding officer, I visited a number of them each summer, but I didn't participate, I'd go back to visit the cadets and visit with the COs to see if there were any problems or any areas of concern. But I never went back as an active.
How do you view the summer camps for what they offered as compared to the term parades?
Well, of course, the summer camps were designed to train you specifically in your major area of interest. If you were a signalman, you went to the Signal Corps Training Center. And of course, there then they concentrated on what was basic to your specialty. And again, they were full-time. They were run as a regular Army camp, taught by regular Army personnel. And on the whole, the first while, I think the cadets found it a bit rigorous, you know, they get some of these hard-nosed military instructors and the training, but on the whole, most of the cadets came back, and after they sort of got over the first week or two, they enjoyed it, I think, on the whole.
Would it be possible to perceive a difference in the cadets who had been to summer camp and returned the following year?
Oh, yes. Yes, you could see quite a change. You bring them in, say, in the first phase of training, in which some of them wouldn't get started with us until after January because maybe the boards wouldn't have made their selection. And then you see them come back the next fall after summer at camp, and you had two different people.
How would you compare the COTC with the, say, the purposes of COTC during the war years and later on?
Well, of course, I suppose during the war years, you're obviously training for war. I don't think there's any question about that. Whether it's war or training for emergencies in the event of war at home or so forth. After the war, and certainly as we got farther away from the end of the war, the whole emphasis on training at the reserve level changed, and it became more oriented to training for community emergencies or disasters. And that's why I say the training, type of military training that they were getting was probably more concerned with this type of training, man management, having people how to handle this as an emergency situation in case of a disaster. Well, as you know, the reserves in some cases did a fair amount of civil defense training laterally. So I think from that point of view, the emphasis on training changed, but it was about that time the COTC folded up as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any specific examples of how the training changed, maybe one particular practice dropped and something new adopted?
Well, except when we went into the emergency training, we got into training for disaster, in the event of disasters, emergencies in this area, which probably are not much different than if you have a bomb go off or if you have an earthquake. The kind of civil disasters, the results of it are essentially the same. So you're trained more along this line, as opposed to, say, training for how to operate a 105 millimeter howitzer or something like that. So that there was some of the syllabus was left out in order to put this other type of emergency training in.
Yes. Was this changing orientation reflected in the lectures?
Yes, because the syllabus then and. Here again, then we used to bring outside lecturers in who had more background in this area. So that the syllabus, again from the director, as time went on, as this is the latter part of the 50s, I guess, the early 60s, that this emphasis shifted from to the emergency training aspect.
How about in terms of world outlook?
Don't recall any.
Would you, for example, maybe have less of a Cold War emphasis and turn more to maybe peacekeeping or the UN?
Well, certainly this latterly was emphasized, that probably the role the Canadians would play in any major conflagration might be sort of as a peacekeeping role, which I think is pretty well what we have been doing, essentially. And this was, I think, emphasized. As far as the Cold War, of course, this was really where the emergency training came in, because we were looking at the atomic bomb. And this is really what I think brought this whole business of civil defense on at that point in time, and we've gone through that phase now. But the emphasis on the civil defense aspect was emphasized because of the Cold War situation. At least in my opinion, that was one of the reasons why we went into this type of training. Not just COTC, but so did the reserves, generally.
How did you become commanding officer?
Well, they appoint a committee, of course, to make the selections. And, I don't know how I was selected. I suppose because of my military background, and I don't know who was even on the selection committee. I imagine there was recommendations put forward by my predecessor. I don't know. And then the committee reviews the senior officers. You see, at that point in time, we had the lieutenant colonel, and then there were, I think, four of us who were majors who would be senior officers.
How did you feel about taking over?
Well, I, of course, was very honored and very looked forward to it, because this is particularly like the fact that I had joined had been with the unit then about 8 or 9 years at this point in time. I enjoyed my involvement with the cadets. I was quite pleased to be selected at that point in time.
How did you perceive of the role of the commanding officer?
Well, of course, at that point in time, the commanding officer, at least in my views, was the man who was there to give leadership, directions, make decisions if they have to be made, and maintain a good organizational setup to carry on the training that was required by the syllabus of training. We, of course, were supported in this regard by a full-time resident staff officer. And they, of course, were the real key to the continuity, if you like, and the liaison with the active forces, so that the contingent officers and the commanding officer per se, he was really the man who was responsible to see that things, that the wheels kept going in the right direction, and was held responsible if they weren't. But he certainly took a lot of his advice from his contingent officers, and in particular his staff officers.
Yes. What were the main issues by your commanding officer?
Well, I suppose the main issue that really happened just towards the latter part of my term was the gearing down and the closing out, of the phasing out, I suppose, is probably a better term, of COTC. It started to develop just about the time I took over. They were cutting back on the numbers of new recruits you could bring in, to the point where your overall establishment was dwindling to the point, again, where I think if you don't have a good, viable organization, it doesn't help to recruit people. And I think the main issue while I was in there was this whole issue of the gradual phasing out of the services on the campus as such, and one which I regret to say I see happen.
This squeezing of quotas started as early as during Colonel McLean.
Oh, yes. Yes, it started before my taking over from Colonel McLean. And he was very instrumental in carrying the fight against this over the years.
How would you wage the fight?
Well, basically it was carried on by the then commanding officers through the headquarters, the local army headquarters. You know, you go through the regular channels to back to Ottawa with Minister of National Defense, who at that point, well, once was General Perks. at the beginning, and then latterly Paul Hellyer. And Mr. Hellyer, who finally put the finishing touches to, whether you can blame him for it per se, but certainly he was minister at the time when they finally withdrew the units from the campus.
When you were commanding officer, the Conservatives were in power at Ottawa.
That's correct.
Were there any difference between them and the Liberals?
No, I think the trend had started, the movement or whatever, whoever was instrumental in phasing this back, basically on the from the point of view, I suppose, of economics, the cost factor. And I think when Mr. Hellyer, I suppose, after General Perks, I guess, came Mr. Hellyer, and it really started under the Conservatives, and it just... Mr. Hellyer's policies are well known about his amalgamation and the whole bit.
Wasn't General Perks favorable towards the military and COTC?
Yes, should have been. It's a difficult thing for somebody like myself to understand, but I guess when you're a politician, you have other problems as well that you have to weigh. Certainly I would think that General Perks, with his background, would have been very favorable to the COTC. But I think it was Mr. Hellyer's was really the one that finally finished it off.
Did you have a, I think you mentioned earlier when I talked to you that you had a meeting with Paul Hellyer.
Well, I've been, yes, Mr. Hellyer was out here and met with the commanding officers. You see, after I took over, we still, because of the fact that it was started under my predecessor, we asked him to stay on sort of as our spokesman because he had the whole background. And Colonel McLean and the other two commanding officers of the Air Force and the Navy met with Mr. Hellyer. And, yes, I can, we had Mr. Hellyer to the mess for lunch. I can remember that very well, sat beside him. I can remember Mr. Hellyer saying to me, Colonel Morrison, we're not in the education field, because I was trying to sell them some of the things we're doing. And I still remember his statement. The federal government's not in the education field. Just what he meant by this, I never could quite get clear from.
Yeah, that's a hard one.
Well, I think what was behind him, because I was trying to point out, you see, that the COTC, or the services, gave a kind of training for these young people that they couldn't get otherwise, a training that would go on into the community in years ahead. You know, I think this is basically why he made this remark, that the federal government was not in the educational field. I presume he felt it was an educational matter.
But defense was something that is national in scope.
That's right. Should be.
Do you remember others who were involved in resisting the eventual disbandment of the COTC?
Well, of course, we had our then president, Colonel McKenzie, or President McKenzie was I don't think he got directly involved, but certainly he was a very active supporter of this of the services on the campus. The late Colonel Logan, of course, was the originator of reactivating the COTC in 1928 after it had been off the campus. People like this, Colonel Schrum, these were all people who had a great deal of knowledge about COTC, and I don't know that how active they were. They were real people that got into the fight to retain. Were the then commanding officers like Colonel McLean, Wing Commander Herbert, and Dr. Young or Captain Young. They probably, as COs, carried out and then mustered whatever other support they could from other people on the campus or in the community.
Mm-hmm. When did you step down as CO?
1963, I think. It was August of 63.
What were the circumstances?
Well, the appointment, the COTC appointment, was on a term basis of 4 years. I think I had a little longer than four and a half, or maybe possibly five. But at that point in time, I felt, you know, somebody else would turn to.
Did you stay with the COTC after?
No. Well, I stayed with them after, but not in an official capacity. I used to attend their functions and still do, as a matter of fact, when they had any military functions.
This last question is going to probably relate to the area you think you talked about before. What do you think is the chief value of COTC for the individual?
Well, I think the one of the chief values, as I see it, is training in the area of man management, if you like, in this general area of how to handle people in the event of disaster, in the event of an emergency. You have a nucleus of people that are out there that have some basic training that you can call on very quickly. And I think we've had evidence of this, the flood of 1948. I was out manning the dikes. The simple reason that all they just, if you like, sort of ordered out the reserves. I think this kind of training is important. As I said earlier, I can see people like John Fraser now, who is MP. I don't say that COTC made him necessarily, but certainly I think it had something to do. And there's several lawyers around town that I can think of, ex cadets of COTC. So I think this kind of training has a great deal to do for people going back out into society.
How do you think COTC serves the country? Oh, let me reword that. What do you think the relationship between COTC and citizenship?
Well, I think there is a definite relationship here, because the training that we were given at that point in time related to citizenship and the involvement of the individual and his responsibility in this particular area of citizenship. I frankly feel that the federal government is back doing much of the same things that we were doing COTC now with some of their programs, but under a different name, and so probably doesn't got the connotation of training for war, but they're trying to do essentially the same sort of thing, teach people citizenship, and teach people number of these areas.
Do you think a person would have a more responsible attitude towards his community?
After training in COTC?
Yes.
My answer would be yes. I can't prove it, but my answer would be yes, having watched the young people and being involved with it myself, that I think he has a greater appreciation of his responsibility to society and to the community generally. How you prove that, I don't know.